The Transmitter.
There were times in Tempest McDonald's life where the world did not feel particularly safe. Obviously, the world did not feel safe when she was sleeping in stairwells. Sometimes it did not feel safe in her personal relationships. And the world did not feel safe when she was a child, around her unstable mother, her parents' volatile relationship. The things that were happening inside my house were terrifying, she told me. Sometimes she found herself expecting the worst. For instance, when her mother took her to the store or the bank and left her in the car, Tempest would wait and silently strategize about what to do if someone tried to snatch her. Other times, she would think about what to do if someone came after her while she waited for the school bus. In that scenario, the best thing, she decided, would be to run to the nearby apartments and try each door until she found one unlocked, and then dart inside. Later, she came to understand that this kind of thinking was a form of self-protection.
I was practicing survival at an early age because the way that I was raised had, what I've come to understand, had activated what I now call the war dial. So I do therapy, and I tell people that there's a war dial and there's a peace dial. They're not the same dial. They are two separate dials. And we'd like to think they're all on one. They're not. And my war dial was activated. And that means I've got trauma responses already playing early. I had my nice trauma dial up, and I was scanning for threat, preparing for threat. And I've learned that people who have experienced life or death situations, who believe that they've been in life or death situations, now have the war dial. They have this thing that tells them that life is not inherently safe. And they have a completely different set of experiences from that point on than people that have the belief that the world is safe.
So you're saying that you yourself have a war dial that you would turn up or down?
The war dial had turned on, and it was turned on actually pretty loud, and it got louder and louder and louder. I didn't know how to turn the peace dial on until much later. I had to learn how to turn that on. And I went through a number of exceedingly painful experiences and a deep desire to change the course of my life to turn the peace dial on. But it took me time to learn that.
But she's also had the experiences I needed to recover from the traumas, she told me. And those experiences, including giving birth to Avis, were the driving forces behind her creating a new life for herself and eventually finding a measure of peace. I'm Brady Huggett, and this is When Autistic Kids Grow Up. Chapter 5, The War Dial. Andy Shu is the chief science officer at Autism Speaks, an advocacy group for autistic people and their families. It is also a funder of autism research. Andy has a PhD in molecular cell biology from New York University School of Medicine, but similar to Tempest and Beth Mallow and many other researchers who study autism, he came to the field through a personal connection.
My cousin has a daughter on the spectrum, and you know, I've known about this for quite a while now, but I'm embarrassed to say that I didn't really pay much attention. Then my cousin became active as an advocate, and she told me about this opportunity at National Alliance for Autism Research.
The National Alliance for Autism Research was a nonprofit advocacy group founded by parents who wanted more funding for autism research. Andy was on the faculty at NYU's medical school when he first heard of the organization, but he was bored, he said.
I took the job because I was interested in the variety of sciences, but I was deeply moved by the families the first year I was in the community and thought that I could have a more purposeful life if I were to contribute.
Andy became part of Autism Speaks when the National Alliance for Autism Research merged with it in 2006. In May 2025, he received the year's Research Advocacy Award from the International Society for Autism Research, also known as INSAR, for his decades-long commitment to advancing research that changes lives. He's also been involved with IAC, the committee discussed in the prior episode, sometimes speaking at its meetings. When he joined the autism community more than 20 years ago, he told me the conception was that autism is a rare disease. But as more evidence was gathered, it became clear that autism is not a disease, he said, and the most important thing is to support autistic people and their families so they can have as good of a life as anybody else.
After 10 years of investment in pediatric, we suddenly realized that these kids grow up, we need to think about adolescent, transition to adulthood, and all those other issues. We want to get ahead of the game a little bit, right? We want to know that, well, these guys also get old, like everybody else. But you know what? We know almost nothing about what their needs are and what are the appropriate solution for them, right? I'll give you a very, very concrete example. So one of my former colleagues came from the Alzheimer's Association. So we were just, you know, chatting one day. And I just asked him, how do you diagnose Alzheimer's or dementia in an older autistic adult? How do you differentiate the cognitive, emotional, functional differences of an autistic, older autistic adult, maybe with different level of support needs, with someone who is going through dementia, right? And the answer is nobody really knows. So that's just one example of how adult medicine in general, it's just not ready for our community at this point.
Research by Lindsay Shea's group at Drexel University in 2021 suggested that adults with autism were about 2.6 times more likely to be diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's disease and related dementias compared to the general population. The study used Medicaid records from 2008 to 2012 to reach this conclusion. But issues affecting autistic people extend beyond the brain. Here's Andy again.
The other area is common diseases, right? But, you know, we know that autistic adults are faced with elevated risk in pretty much every common disease you can think about, non-communicable disease, stroke, dementia, cancer, diabetes, you name it, they experience it. So what is shocking to me, you know, when we dig a little deeper into this, is that number one, there's not a sense that there's expertise and understanding among the adult practitioner of adult medicine. You know, you ask, say, oncologists, or a psychologist, when's the last time you saw a patient with autism? You know, with 3% of the population, they saw someone with autism. Are you doing anything different? Do you even know that you saw an autistic patient?
Andy Schur said that Autism Speaks has been thinking about a neuro-inclusive care model. The idea, he said, is that the model will take into account the biological and the behavioral and cognitive differences about autistic people and use that to create a more accommodating pathway to clinical care. Autism Speaks has been changing its priorities to reflect this. In Autism Speaks' first 5 years of existence, it funded 7 studies that focus on autistic adults. Since 2010, it has funded 29 studies. So that is an uptick. But the group also sees its role as helping change the way the NIH funds autism research. If riskier studies are first funded by Autism Speaks, researchers might then submit proposals to the NIH for deeper exploration. Those proposals should, in theory, expose the NIH to newer, more innovative ideas and broaden the NIH's understanding of the autism research field. And that, in turn, should help change the way the NIH doles out money. Or anyway, that's how Andy sees it. But so far, that has not really happened.
Yeah, you know, you go to the IACC meeting, right? So you get represented from all the major departments of government sitting around the table. They talk about the stuff they're doing, okay? Some of them pretty nice and sounds good and so on and so forth. But then you leave that meeting and you think about, I came to this meeting last year and I'm here today. What difference had that year made for our community? And most of the time, because of what they've been investing in, the answer is not much.
Andy told me that at IAC meetings 10 years ago, there was plenty of hand-wringing and anxiety because the country was not really funding enough on the lifespan issue, he said. Since then, more focus has indeed moved toward lifespan by IAC's analysis, but the disparity remains outsized. IAC tracks research funding into autism by area of focus. In 2015, about 50% of all funding went into the biology or risk factors behind autism. That's about $170 million. But just 2%, or about $6 million, went into lifespan issues. By 2020, which is the last time IAC broke down the funding by area of focus, about $264 million were allocated to biology and genetic and environmental factors. That's about 63%. Meanwhile, the money for lifespan issues did improve to $18 million, but that is still just 4.3% of all the funding for autism research that IAC tracks. You'll recall that the CDC estimated that there are about 5.4 million adults with autism in the United States, based on 2017 data. The CDC told me it does not have a current estimate for the number of autistic adults in the future, but it has updated its estimates for autism prevalence in kids in the U.S., and it puts the figure at 1 in 31 8-year-olds. That puts the percentage of U.S. children who are autistic at about 3.2%. If you multiply that percentage by the 2024 estimated number of adults in the United States, it suggests something like 8.5 million of them are autistic. I put this scenario to Andusha and said if there was some other 8.5 million person population in this country that had something in common that was driving their life expectancy down by 16 years, there would be a massive outcry about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? But it's just like, it's shocking that nobody's really paying attention to this, right? But to be fair, okay, I think part of the issue that nobody's really thinking about this is because there's so much to do today. There's so much to do to make sure that your child is getting the next you know, intervention treatment that's been scheduled. There's so much to do trying to figure out how you're going to put food on the table when food insecurity is a huge issue for our community. It's a huge issue when your child is being kicked out of school or disciplined for whatever reason, and we see that in the national statistics. You know, so you don't think about what's going to be coming up in 5 years.
I asked Andy if he thought that it was up to healthcare providers and the government to understand what the autistic community will be facing.
I totally agree, right? But then if you talk to clinicians, right, and you already know that if you talk to a pediatrician, they say, we got 15 minutes per patient. You want us to do what else?
Yeah.
Right? And you can imagine a similar scenario for adult clinicians as well, right? So they have to spend more time with these patients. They have to provide accommodation. But where's a system that will support that kind of change in the practice?
There's a metaphor people use to describe how our healthcare system is unprepared to deal with the increasing number of autistic adults. Tsunami. Andy used it with me too. The autism community can be fractured, with the desires of parents not always aligned with the desires of autistic self-advocates or the desires of researchers or funding providers. There is a lot of need in these communities. Everyone seems to have their own angle, and sometimes this devolves into squabbling. But the topic of increased funding for research into autistic adults seems like sure, common ground. The Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, for instance, has a similar view as Autism Speaks. Here is Zoe Gross, Director of Advocacy at ASAN. She also appeared in Chapter 4.
We need more research about conditions that co-occur with autism. At the clinical level, a lot of the time, autistic people will present with some of these co-occurring conditions and be told, like, oh, that's just part of autism. And really what's going on is they may have a condition that is frequently co-occurring with autism but isn't the same thing as autism, like POTS or Ehlers-Danlos syndrome or various gastrointestinal issues or sleep disorders. So people wanted to see more research on those and their intersection with autism and, like, best practices in treatment, because we know for autistic people, the treatment that works best for us may not always be what works best for other people with the same conditions.
The condition POTS that Zoe mentioned is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, where the heart rate increases significantly upon standing. It's recognized to potentially have a higher prevalence in autistic people. She also told me that ASAN wants to see more research on autism throughout the lifespan. The truth is, anything that needs more study actually means it needs more money. Parents, autistic self-advocates, and researchers are sometimes seen as fighting over where the money should go. But bickering over where to direct the money, says Andy Shura, is a false choice.
It speaks to one of my pet peeves about autism research funding. I don't understand the need to say, you fund this and I'll fund that, right? And there's also a sense that you know, if you fund this type of research, then maybe you shouldn't fund the other type of research, or you don't have the resource to fund the other type of research. Because as advocates, for me, all of this research are important. And if you even take a step back, looking at it from a scientific perspective, right? In order to develop a 360 solution for our community, you can't just invest in 2 degrees, 360. You have to think comprehensively. So the answer is not, should NIH only fund basic science, or should somebody else, like Department of Labor, or maybe MAHA, whatever, everybody should fund autism research. I don't care who you are, whether you're at NIH, or you're DOJ, whether you're a community group, whether you're state government, everybody has a stake in this issue.
I also spoke with Thomas Frazier, a professor of psychology at John Carroll University, where he heads the Frazier Neurodevelopment Lab. He is also a former member of IAC, and he's the chairman of the board at Autism Speaks. I asked him about what Andy Shaw and I talked about, the funding levels for research into autistic adults and the need for a bigger pie.
We just need a general increase in autism research, so that general increase can easily help to support the adult work that we need. I mean, we're underfunded as a condition, right? I mean, we are underfunded. If you compare the prevalence of autism to other conditions that are better funded than us, it's really, you know, it's a significant problem for us.
I then asked him what the funding might look like if we were discussing an established, well-known health condition that limited the lifespan of millions of Americans.
There'd be 10x the amount of money funding going towards that condition. 10x. You know, and I think this is a real, I mean, you know, I'm a proud American, and I love the progress in our society when it occurs, but this is an area that we all need to look in the mirror on and say, you know, you have to do better for this population. You have to. Otherwise, you're not a progressing society.
The Trump administration in the United States has made looking at autism a priority for the country, citing the CDC's rising prevalence numbers. As part of a September 22, 2025 press event, the National Institutes of Health Director Jay Bhattacharya announced that the Autism Data Science Initiative would provide $50 million to find the root causes of autism or therapies for it. The program will fund 13 projects. Only one looks at the health of autistic adults. That work is being led by Laura Klinger, who is a clinical psychologist and the executive director at the Teach Autism program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she's also a professor in the Department of Psychiatry. The funding will support an examination of autistic adults and their needs and use of services in an attempt to better inform the healthcare and service systems. The project will include UNC, Drexel University, George Washington University, the University of Pittsburgh, the University of Wisconsin, and the Children's National Medical Center. This kind of support for research into autistic adults, Klinger said, has been a long time coming.
Because back in the day, it was called, you know, early childhood autism, and autism was thought to be a childhood diagnosis, and it was thought to be something that you would eventually grow out of, or with intervention services, that you would no longer be autistic. And so I think even, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, there was a real focus in the field on the concept of cure. And then as we have moved forward across time, both in clinical services and in research, community outreach services, it turns out that many autistic children grow up to become autistic adults. And then I think the field really had to pause and say, well, what do we know about autistic adults?
UNC's TEACH program began in 1972. Klinger says that puts the program ahead of the curve in its thinking about adults. TEACH employees have watched autistic children grow into adulthood. Her group was already hoping to collaborate with the other programs on the project, she said, before they received the government funding. The funding just makes it possible to actually do it. But the problem is more than just about money, she said. She has graduate students who are interested in autism in adulthood, but are struggling to find graduate programs to enroll in. The scientific discipline of autism in adulthood hasn't yet been figured out, she said.
We need a workforce interested in research on autism in adulthood. And if you have that interest, what's your workforce pathway? Like, where does your training go? And I think that we, you know, as a university community, haven't figured out that pathway. It's hard to be an expert on autism in adulthood. And if you look at most of us who are considered experts on autism in adulthood, most of us were not trained with a focus on adults. So it's hard to move the field because we don't actually have the workforce.
Years ago, Klinger submitted grant applications to look at Parkinson's and autism and got no headway with funding, she told me. Grant reviewers did not understand why it might be important to study Parkinson's and autism. The same thing happens with research publishing. We're trying to fund research or publish research that hasn't reached the level of community awareness that warrants funding or publication, she told me. Part of the challenge today with autistic adults has been to make it clear that this is an important topic to be funded and published. She does think it's changing, though. The fact that her work was chosen for federal support means the consciousness is slowly being raised. I asked her if she'd heard about Tempest's NIH paper. She hadn't, so I sent it to her. After she'd read it, she told me she agreed with the authors that it was pointing to a serious problem. She did not agree that the cause was structural discrimination or a focus on eugenics at NIH, as the paper argued. But in her mind, the data result from a confluence of events that have left autistic adults behind.
It's like you have to reshape the whole system. You have to reshape the service delivery system. You have to reshape the education and academic training system and the NIH review system to figure out where autism and adulthood fits. And what that article is talking about is sort of the downstream results of not having a workforce, not having review panels with that focus, you know, not having the general public aware that autism happens in adulthood. It's almost like we need a public media campaign like we did about, you know, identifying the early signs of autism earlier.
So, you know, all the things, review panels, mm-hmm. It's hard to get things published, blah, blah, blah. The public doesn't know. And you said you'd have to change the whole structure. Because you'd have to change the whole structure, that's why it's moving slowly.
I think so.
After Avis was born, Tempest lost the baby weight very rapidly, she said, 3 months or so. And she also lost the ability to produce milk. She was struggling as a new mother. The parenting book she'd read didn't apply to what she was dealing with, she told me. She felt anxious, her body revved up. She made an appointment through Medicaid for both a family medicine doctor and a psychiatrist. She saw the psychiatrist who led her through the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Test, a questionnaire designed to help diagnose mental health conditions. When she saw the family physician, they drew blood for tests. She got the blood work results first, and it showed she had Graves' disease, the autoimmune disorder that drives hyperthyroidism and the very thing that had plagued her mother. So she had that diagnosis in her back pocket when she sat down with a psychiatrist, who laid out his case for her being bipolar, she said.
And he goes on to say that my, you know, based on this, and this is what the treatments were, and all of these things. And I let him say the whole thing because I really wanted to hear what he had to say. And when he got finished, he asked me if I had any questions. I said, I do. So I have my test results from the internal doctor, and it says I have Graves' disease. And he begins to say, well, in that case, I'm going to want you to come back because Graves' disease revs up your adrenal systems, and it gives you kind of manic thinking and causes intense anxiety.
Hyperthyroidism has been linked to autism in some studies. Tempest was indeed treated for Graves' disease, she said. But she was disturbed by how she was nearly wrongly diagnosed, and she's watched similar things play out with her son. Avis is approaching 30 years of age now. He recently was in a car accident. Not his fault. Avis is a rule follower and a careful driver. It was the other car that went against the traffic light. He was on his way to a job interview at the local supermarket. Here he is.
Was it in a, like, at an intersection? What happened?
Yeah, it was like, I didn't really get to leave the a neighborhood before trouble struck, essentially.
Yeah. And you got, I think your mom said you got T-boned or hit in the side or?
Yeah, T-boned on the driver's side, actually. And I said what happened to the police. And there was a witness who backed up my side of the story, which was that... And this is actually what happened. I was looking both ways at the stop. And as I turned, there was a red vehicle. A red vehicle that had made it to the stop sign as I was turning, and it didn't stop, even as I was already in there. I don't remember if I was quick enough to honk the horn, but very soon after I felt it, it got impacted.
Avis was incredibly sore that night, he told me, but not injured enough to see a doctor or visit the hospital. And that was fine by him. He has not had a positive experience overall with medical institutions. The family still talks about the removal of Avis's wisdom teeth. He was an adult by then, and Terry took him to the appointment. The dentist extracted 3 teeth, but the last one proved difficult. The dentist worked on it for an hour, Terry told me, and Avis told me he woke up in the middle of the procedure, but still the dentist dug away. Finally, Terry went back into the exam room and saw that Avis was suffering, he said. He's had enough, Terry told the dentist, and he made him stop. Tempest showed up soon after and lambasted the dentist, Avis said, and she took him to the emergency room to have his jaw checked. And from then on, she's made a point of accompanying him to his health appointments.
Doctors and dentists still remain an enigma and frustrating to me. They often either speak super fast or they seem to pressure things on you.
Avis eventually had the last wisdom tooth removed, but he's been pressured at other times, he said. Once he had a gallstone. The doctor suggested they schedule him for surgery to take out his gallbladder. The family thought that seemed extreme. That experience, and others, is why doctors give Avis anxiety, he said, and his experience makes him feel like sometimes they don't listen. Like many people with autism, Avis has co-occurring conditions. He is overweight. The CDC has found an association between obesity and autistic teens. He has sleep issues, gastrointestinal issues. Both are commonly occurring in autistic people. And like Tempest, he has Ehlers-Danlos, an inherited disorder that mainly affects connective tissue like skin, joints, and blood vessel walls. And he's been diagnosed with diabetes.
And some other troubles I have are kind of expounded by having Ehlers-Danlos, so... there's a whole bunch of things that are wrong with me that are largely due to Ehlers-Danlos.
Yeah.
It seems like both my Ehlers-Danlos and my autism cause perfect storms of issues for me, like my texture issues combined with digestive issues. There's already some problems for sensory things from my autism, and then you've got Ehlers-Danlos in the picture.
Yeah.
Mucking about.
The doctors he sees don't seem to know anything about co-occurring conditions, Tempest told me. For much of his life, Tempest has been his advocate in the healthcare system. They are fortunate, she said, because she knows a lot about autism and what it can be linked to. We bring information to the doctors, she said. It's almost never the other way around. It's just one of the many ways she and Terry have helped guide Avis through his life. I asked him about this.
Well, where do you think, I mean, it's a difficult question, but where would you be without the two of them looking out for you like that?
I know, if I didn't have my grandfather, I probably would be a little less healthy than I am now. But my mom, though... That is really hard to think. And it's not just because it's difficult to get a perspective, but seeing how a lot of the students who weren't as fortunate as I have been, with a mother who was a little too stubborn to let me be more severe than I am, I think I might not be in a good play. I think I would probably be not nearly as independent as I am now. I mean, I'm not fully independent, but I would be even less. And I would possibly be nonverbal. Mm-hmm. I would probably be working in a really bad job. I probably wouldn't be going to college. I'm almost certain of that.
Avis has since finished his degree. He has a bachelor's in business administration with a concentration in management. The American philosopher Martha Nussbaum in 2000 published her book, Women and Human Development, The Capabilities Approach. In it, she laid out 10 capabilities that are used to assess the quality of life of an individual. It's worth looking up, but they are, roughly paraphrased, concerned with an individual's ability to not die prematurely, to have good health, to have freedom of expression, to have social interaction, to be able to play, to have a voice in what happens to them, among other concerns. Nussbaum argued that all 10 capabilities are required to have a full, flourishing human life. Elizabeth Pelicano is a professor of autism research at University College London, though she was born in Australia. Earlier in her career, Liz researched autistic children, but over time, her priorities definitely shifted, she told me, and now most of her work is on young people or adults.
I think in the case of autistic people, we haven't really asked, you know, what a good life actually means to them, and whether that's even different to what anybody else's, a non-autistic person's good life might be, and what it therefore means for them to flourish.
In September 2022, Elizabeth Pelicano and colleagues published an article in Nature Reviews Psychology titled, A Capabilities Approach to Understanding and Supporting Autistic Adulthood. In this paper, the authors applied Martha Nussbaum's capabilities approach, which focuses on 10 core elements of a thriving human life, to research on autistic adulthood. In doing so, they identify areas where autistic adults thrive and where they often struggle, they wrote. The 10 capabilities are a starting point, Pelicano wrote, but at a basic level, autistic people cannot thrive without meeting the 10 capabilities laid out in Pelicano's work. When Terry moved in with Avis and Tempest in her condo, her first home purchase, it caused a reorganization of her existence, she said. Her period of being without a home had left a mark on her psyche, and thus the condo purchase was a big deal. It was protection against eviction and homelessness, an assurance that she was going to have a home for her son. She told me the desperation she felt when she left home at 16 never truly went away, but since the purchase of the condo, it's gotten better. She is done with academic life. Maybe that's for the best, she said, because otherwise she'd still be stressed about writing grants to cover my income. She's now a counselor at the State of Tennessee's Department of Disability and Aging, working specifically with individuals who have an intellectual disability and who have also been charged with a crime. She has a licensed private practice called Spectrum for Life Counseling, and she wants to support the neurodivergent community. Avis is pondering opening a hobbyist shop for people who love the futuristic role-playing game Warhammer 40,000 as much as he does. People would come to the shop for the community to play the game and to buy supplies, so he's been thinking about that. He also serves as a caregiver for Terry, whose cancer is in remission, though he also had surgery for an aneurysm in 2024. With academia behind her now, I asked Tempest to take stock of her own life.
I am thriving. I'm thriving right now.
I mean, so if I can preface that by saying, I think if someone looked at you and said, well, I mean, yes, obviously you had a rough beginning. No one's going to deny that. But you ended up getting like a PhD. I'm like, that sounds like a person who in the end kicked down a lot of doors and was able to thrive. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I'm a fighter. I'm a warrior.
Yeah.
By nature. I'm a warrior by nature. I have had sort of an unusual path because I had a certain type of intelligence combined with a learning disability, combined with being autistic, combined with coming from my household, which was an autistic household, and interfacing with the world and discovering that the world didn't exactly want to interface with me the way I wanted to interface with it. when I was a kid, if I could have just played games with somebody else all the time, I would have.
Yeah.
If we would have played games, and I would have wanted the games to get harder and harder. I would have wanted to play chess, and I would have wanted to do it from sunup to sundown. Nobody wanted to do that with me. I wasn't making friends. My friends, when I made them, were temporary. I didn't know how to get along with people. And so it's exceedingly difficult to know if I always liked being alone. I think that's always been a part of my nature. Or if I also was just alone and trying to figure out existence.
Yeah.
I found existence to be really interesting. And it is one of the most satisfying parts of being alive, I think, is really thinking about the mystery of existence.
Uh-huh. So you're thriving now.
I am thriving. The housing, so many people in this country are experiencing a housing crisis. I experienced it my entire life, and I managed to solve it. You know, knock on wood, I've managed to solve it. And part of my solution was, it's a collective solution. It's not like I'm doing this alone. Avis is a big part of the success of this. My dad's a big part of the success of this.
Yeah.
And so we are three generations. Is that right? Three generations in one house. Yeah. My math is right. And for us, it's a solution. But it's only a solution because I spent decades learning how to, ironically, manage conflict. Right?
Yeah.
Like, clearly not to a T with employment and with discrimination and all kinds of things. But certainly in my actual interpersonal relationships, I work hard at it.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it so that we can live together and I have lovely, intelligent family members who, do their part in that too. I feel like if we had all been taught explicitly sooner, it would have been a lot easier, faster, sooner.
With her new career and the relationships in her house finding an equilibrium, she has time again to focus on the future.
Can I set you up for the existential question?
I'm ready now.
You ready?
Yeah. All right.
So you've had experiences in your life where you could have died, right? This is the tree coming down on the car while you're sleeping in it, or whether it was a car wreck.
Yeah.
And so that you had sort of realized that really that we're all mortal and that life can be taken away. I think you said, like, it's just a breath away that something like this could happen. So given what we just talked about, that your family is all under this one roof, it's operating as a pretty good machine right now, everyone's mm-hmm. doing their part, what happens if you're taken away from that? And I think probably in particular, I am thinking about Avis.
Once my career is really taking off, I'm not there yet, I'm on the cusp of it. But once mine goes, getting my home paid off as soon as possible, because that affects his ability to, if I'm gone, if Dad's gone, he can rent rooms. And then the place is big, and that was part of the reason getting, all of this, and I've been talking about it since the beginning, is if it reaches a point, we can rent out the rooms. And then that becomes something that forms a form of income. But then part of that portfolio that I have to create for him, and we're in the process of helping him work towards that, is how do you get a roommate?
Yeah.
How do you handle conflicts with a roommate? And so that's part of it. And that's sort of like this creative way. He has been off of Social Security. He's been a caregiver for my dad. He's interested in getting a part-time job. He now recognizes that work is essential for his health, which is an irony, because work is killing a lot of people. And Avis is in the process of, like, how can we figure out a way to do that? So we're in a hopeful place right now. I worry about health issues more. The other thing is that I need to start putting together not just, I've got some retirement there. At some point I want to keep putting away things for him and get it to where he's going to be okay.
Yeah.
We're not there.
Yeah.
We're not there. But I think also with having a stable home, Avis runs the ability of being able to go through some of life's hard knocks, maybe without support that he would have with people, but in the way that my dad and I went through them, which is, pretty rough, but not as rough as it could have been.
Yeah.
And, you know, which will be getting jobs, getting fired, feeling desperate.
Moving all the time.
Well, we moved all the time. But yeah, I mean, Avis won't have to.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Where's your war dial at right now?
My war dial. It's really low.
In the house, it's peaceful.
I am really happy in my home. In fact, that's almost a mantra I have. I don't know it's a mantra, except I'll be sitting and I'll be in my living room and I'll be looking across at some little part of my place that I, you know, it's crafted. Everything in here is like crafted in a way that when I look at it, I'm like, oh, I like that. Oh, I like that. And my mantra is like, I like it here. I do. I'm on a pool team. They forced me to be the captain of the team. I keep trying to quit. It's nice to get my competitive side out there.
Yeah.
I'm dancing more. I'm working out more. I'm
good.
Yeah. That's something, isn't it?
Yeah. That's it.
When Autistic Kids Grow Up was written and produced by me, Brady Huggett. Editing by Ivan Aransky and Paige Miranda. Art commissioned by Rebecca Horn. Music and audio engineering by Sam Schumann. Go to the podcast page of thetransmitter.org to see photographs for this chapter and for a PDF transcript. And thank you to Tempest McDonald, Terry, and Avis for sharing your life.